This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court takes another look at the contentious issue of the juvenile death penalty. The United States is the only industrialized nation and one of the few in the world to apply the death penalty to youthful offenders. On one hand, capital punishment is reserved for heinous cases with details that rarely elicit much public sympathy. The question the justices will address, though, is whether science and social norms have turned the execution of 16- and 17-year-old offenders into cruel and unusual punishment. Currently, 14 states allow the death penalty for murderers who committed their crimes when they were as young as 16. Since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976, 22 people in that group have been executed. According to the American Bar Association, more than 70 are on death row right now. Today, a look at the argument of the Supreme Court's way from the science of brain development to the changing social attitudes and global standards. Later in the program, how police handle missing juvenile cases, why a 17-year-old girl trapped in her car for 8 days was classified as a runaway. That's later in the program. Now, we want to hear from you. If you have questions about how the nation applies the death penalty to young people, give us a phone call. Have community standards changed over the past 15 years? And how do we deal with the most violent young offenders? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can email us, TOTN@NPR.org. Joining us now here in Studio 3A is Peter Rubin, Professor of Constitutional Law at Georgetown University. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Give us some background on this case. We mentioned it was 15 years ago when the Supreme Court ruled on the death penalty for juveniles, and we're strictly talking about 16 and 17-year-olds here?
Well, in this case, a 17-year-old offender is at issue. The court will have to decide whether the execution of juvenile offenders violates the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishments. The test the court has articulated for that is whether it offends evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. The interesting thing about this is, as you've suggested, 15 years ago in 1989, the Supreme Court answered this very question, and they said, no, the Eighth Amendment did not prohibit the execution of juvenile offenders. The question was only reopened a couple of years ago in 2002 when the Supreme Court overruled another 1989 case that had held that the execution of the mentally retarded did not violate the Eighth Amendment. In 2002 in Atkins versus Virginia, the Supreme Court held that it did, and such executions are now unlawful in the United States. And the question we'll see answered by the court here in this case is whether the same mode of analysis, the same evolution of community standards has taken place with respect to the execution of juvenile offenders.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about evolving social standards a little bit later, but in what ways has the court changed over the past 15 years? You said at the top of the program that you thought Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who was on the court 15 years ago, would cast the deciding opinion this time.
Well, it's extraordinary, really, because the court has moved rightward quite dramatically since 15 years ago. Justices Brennan, Marshall, and Blackmun, the three liberal lions of the late 20th century Supreme Court, retired. Each of them has actually since passed away. They've been replaced by far less liberal justices. There is no liberal wing of the court at all, and their replacements include Clarence Thomas, Justice David Souter, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I guess I think that what's interesting is despite this rightward shift on the court in Atkins changed its opinion about whether society itself rejected execution of the mentally retarded. And that suggests that although the court has moved rightward, society has, in fact, come to view some of the uses of the death penalty in the United States. Obviously, not all uses of the death penalty. 69 or 70% of Americans, polling data suggests, still support the death penalty generally. But its use against some classes of defendants obviously has come to strike people as cruel or inhumane in a way that it hadn't as recently as 15 years ago.
So what arguments can we expect the court to be hearing when this case comes up?
Well, there are a number of different types of arguments. Broadly speaking, the question will be whether juvenile offenders have the same degree of culpability as other offenders, so that the question is whether the death penalty serves a legitimate purpose here. Does it serve a legitimate deterrent purpose? Does it make sense to want to impose the same kinds of retribution on juveniles as on full-grown adults. And there you mentioned at the top of the hour something about brain science.
Mm-hmm.
There is new science about the development of the brain that is highly relevant to that question. The broader question will be, does it offend basic concepts of human dignity to execute someone who is an offender as a juvenile? You also suggested that the United States is among the few countries that executes juveniles, and this is an interesting piece of it, the international piece of it. The United States is the only country with an organized government that hasn't ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Every other country in the world has. This is an international treaty that prohibits executing juvenile offenders. And indeed, the United States is the only country in the world, aside from Iran and Pakistan, to have executed more than one juvenile offender in the last decade. So it's not a particularly savory group that the few states in the United States that still do this are among.
I assume the arguments on the other side will include that, well, if you look at the specifics in the case in question, and this is the case of Roper v. Simmons, this was a 17-year-old boy who they robbed a house, tied the victim up in duct tape, and threw her off a bridge.
You can't gainsay the heinousness of the offenses that these people are convicted of. They are not merely convicted of murder, of course. They're sentenced to death. And in the United States, under a series of Supreme Court precedents, that is reserved for the most heinous types of crimes. So that's not that can't be ignored. And undoubtedly, some of the response to these crimes is based on that. The question is whether there's a moral judgment that despite that gravity and that seriousness, that these offenders are somehow less culpable, or that society as a moral matter ought not to be imposing the ultimate punishment upon them.
We're talking about the juvenile death penalty. If you'd like to call us, our number, 800-989-8255. You can email us, totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Paula. Paula's calling from Huntsville, Indiana.
Hello.
Hi.
I have been a juvenile court prosecutor for many years. I'm not currently, but I have been, and I don't think today's juries would be inclined to impose that penalty given all the questions that have come around about, improper withholding of evidence, discovery games. I also think that we have a real dearth of services for the severely mentally ill and violent youth. And, you know, morally, even though I have put my share of people in the Department of Correction, I would not be comfortable with having this penalty for minors. My state has actually abolished it. You have to be 18 to receive it in Indiana. That was done legislatively. But given that we don't have anything to treat the really sick, the violent, the very disturbed young offenders, our law requires that we try a panoply of services before we try kids as adults and give them adult penalties. And I don't think we're really doing that effectively with the very sick and the very disturbed. So in answer to the gentleman's question, I don't really think we'd get a jury to do that right now in my state. I may be wrong, but I just don't see it on the horizon. I think people have real reservations.
Is that your experience, Peter Rubin?
Well, I think that the fact that Indiana has abolished the juvenile death penalty tells us something. It is certainly true that the trend in the United States has been to less and less sentences of death imposed on juvenile offenders. And in the past 10 years, only three states, Texas, Oklahoma, and Virginia, have actually executed juvenile offenders in the United States. There are 78 juvenile offenders, as you suggested, 78 juvenile offenders in the United States right now who are either on death row or whose cases are still in litigation about whether their sentences of death will be ultimately affirmed. So there are people do have different opinions about it. And there has been, despite the movement, for example, in states like Indiana and most other states, there are people who feel otherwise and juries who have felt otherwise.
Just for clarification again, the law is now if you committed a crime when you were 15 years old, it is illegal to be, you cannot use the death penalty. It does not apply anywhere in the country.
There is nowhere in the United States where you can be executed for an offense committed at the age of 15. It's an open question whether there might be a way for a state to reimpose that if they did it in the proper way, but no one has has done so.
Peter Rubin, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Peter Rubin, professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University, was here with us in Studio 3A. Joining us now is M. Jane Brady, attorney general for the state of Delaware, and thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Delaware is one of six states that signed on to an amicus brief in support of maintenance of the death penalty for juveniles. How come?
Well, I think that the purpose of the brief, which is to say that there is no factual basis upon which to draw a clear line that says no 16- or 17-year-old offender should be considered for the death penalty, there's not been any factual basis established that would just support drawing that clear line. I think that the decision about whether to impose the death penalty on a 16- or 17-year-old offender should be based on the same criteria that we use to determine whether it's appropriate to impose the death penalty in any other offender's case, and that is a consideration of the facts and the circumstances of the crime, the nature and character of the defendant, and the specific circumstances of that offender in deciding whether it's the appropriate penalty.
Since the death penalty was reinstated by the Supreme Court, Delaware has not sentenced a minor offender to death. Why fight to keep a penalty your state doesn't use?
Because I don't know that there won't be a case where it's appropriate. We've actually sought it. We had two that qualified since the Supreme Court made the decision that offenders 16 and older could receive the death penalty. In one case, and this goes to a comment by your previous caller about that seemed to equate mentally retarded and limited individuals with violent behavior. In one case, the offender was severely limited mentally, and no matter what their age, we probably would not have pursued the death penalty. In the other instance, the jury voted by a majority to impose the death penalty, but in our state, the court makes the ultimate finding. The jury makes a recommendation, and the court determined not to impose the death penalty in that case.
Mm-hmm. You do draw a line at 15 years of age.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court drew that line and said that offenders younger than 16 cannot be considered for the death penalty. And I think a lot of the literature that's come out about the maturity of individuals, understanding the gravamen of a situation, was part of what formed the basis for the court's decision, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in that case. I had actually had a potentially capital case pending at the time that the court was considering that, where two young men under the age of 18, but one was under 16 at the time of the offense, had murdered a young man who was sleeping in a home they burglarized because they wanted to see what it felt like to kill someone.
Hmm. Is this a big political issue in Delaware?
Not particularly. Overwhelmingly, my state supports the death penalty, and I think based on the experience that the public has had with the prosecution in my state, there's a lot of confidence in the integrity of the decisions of guilt and of the imposition of the death penalty in Delaware.
And clearly it's something that you haven't done it. It's not done lightly.
No, it's not done lightly. Although, as I said, in the one case where we pursued the death penalty that qualified, Delaware, of course, has very few murders compared to many states because we have much fewer people than many other states. But in the one case, the jury did vote by a majority to impose the death penalty in their recommendation to the court, but the judge did not impose it.
Thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
M. Jane Brady is Attorney General of the state of Delaware, and she joined us today on the phone from Dover, Delaware. We're going to continue this conversation when we come back from a short break. We're talking about the juvenile death penalty and whether it is still constitutional. We'll look at what science tells us about young offenders and what it doesn't. If you have questions about how the juvenile death penalty is applied today, 800-989-8255, email us, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about the juvenile death penalty. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court hears arguments about whether or not it is acceptable to execute youthful offenders. What they mean by that is, in this case, people who committed heinous murders at the ages of 16 or 17 years. If you have questions about the arguments in favor or against, or about how other countries deal with young violent criminals, you're invited to join the discussion a little bit later in the program. We'll also be talking about some of the scientific evidence about brain development and youthful offenders. If you're interested in that, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can email us as well, TOTN at NPR.org. Many of the arguments on both sides in the case tomorrow will be anecdotal. After all, the deterrent power of the death penalty and the evolving standards of acceptable punishment are hard to quantify, but some aspects can be measured. Joining us now is Jeffrey Fagan, professor of law and public health at Columbia University. He joins us from Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me.
You've just completed a statistical study on how often courts impose the death penalty on juveniles. What did you find?
Well, we found that there's been a very sharp decline since 1999, and there's actually been a strong decline going back to 1994. In the number of death sentences imposed on juveniles. And we wondered if, in fact, this was a function of the decline in juvenile homicide rate or decline in just simply the number of arrests. And it turns out that, in fact, this rate of decline is far greater than the rate of decline for adults. And it's the number of juvenile death sentences for every juvenile homicide arrest also has gone down sharply since 1994. And it's kind of hard to escape the conclusion that the legal system, judges and juries in particular, are using the juvenile death sentence, the juvenile death penalty, extremely rarely now, almost at the point of its extinction.
And for the purposes of tomorrow's argument before the court, that would say, look, if people aren't using it, they don't like it.
Well, that's right. We asked a question that I think was posed by the justices in a series of cases, which was essentially: is there an evolving societal norm that opposes the use of the death penalty for a particular population? And we interpreted the decline that we saw as being a sign of that norm.
Mm-hmm. Any other ways to measure these norms, social norms?
Well, there are ways. One could do random surveys of populations and say that, are you willing to do it? And in fact, support for the juvenile death penalty has declined quite sharply among the general population as well. But the relevant test that the Supreme Court has laid out is exactly what the judges and juries do, as well as what the prosecutors do. But the court test really focuses on the decisions of judges and juries, and that's where we focused our research as well.
Let's get a caller on the line. Gerard joins us from Oklahoma City.
Hi, I wanted to ask, Justice Scalia, in one of his opinions in Stanford versus Kentucky, has said that the application of the death penalty should not be based on public opinion polls, and rather it should be on objective factors. But later in Atkins versus Virginia says that objective factors should be taken into account. How do you kind of reconcile the two there?
Atkins was an interesting decision because the court there looked in several different places for signs of this question of an evolving norm. They looked at state legislation, which had very steadily since the preceding mental retardation case, which was Penry versus Lindnaw. A very large number of states, I believe 22 states, had passed legislation opposing the use of execution for mentally retarded persons. But the court also there acknowledged, in fact, that there was some role for international opinion, and the court also looked at the decisions of judges and juries as well there. So, and they also cited social science and medical science evidence about the very special vulnerability of mentally retarded persons to wrongful confessions, false confessions, which might lead to their wrongful conviction. So I think the court looked in several different places for signs of evolving norms and different objective criteria by which to gauge the question of cruel and unusual punishment.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Gerard. Let's go now to Brenda. Brenda's calling from St. Louis.
Hi.
I
don't have a question. It's just I was an investigator working with the Missouri Capital Punishment Resource Center and got on board shortly before I got the opportunity to work on the case of Fred Lashley, who was 17 at the time he committed his offense, which he had murdered one of his caretakers, a relative, a cousin. And his appeal to the Supreme Court had been turned down. Mm-hmm. And I, as I said, I was an investigator on his case and worked on his case for about 3 months trying to make a clemency appeal to the governor of Missouri at that time. This was probably 1993, summer of 1993. And it was to no avail, and Fred was executed. But I think that's what at the time probably convinced me that the death penalty was totally inappropriate for this community, for this country, and, you know, no matter what the way that it's done, it's still a barbaric type of experience.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. This case that the court will hear tomorrow comes out of the state of Missouri. How long ago was the case you're talking about, Brenda?
Fred Lashley's case. He was executed in 1993. He was 17 at the time he committed the offense and 29 when he was executed. So I'm guessing, because I came in on the case at the very last portion of it, he probably was convicted sometime in 1982, 83 perhaps.
Hmm.
I'm not exactly sure, but in his case, his family history was just unimaginable. It was nothing you could make up. And he'd been treated horribly. When his relatives got tired of him, they would just take him to juvenile and drop him off. It was terrible. He just had, and I can't quite remember all the details, but, his life demanded more than that, and it was just, it wound up being almost, just a really hopeless situation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that he had changed in the interim, in those 12 years, and, certainly made another case for why the death penalty shouldn't even be used by a country like this.
Obviously, his cousin who died, I mean, this doesn't mitigate, well, I guess you're arguing it doesn't mitigate, it doesn't excuse it.
No, it doesn't at all. I'm sorry if you said if it doesn't mitigate it, no. But I tell you, his family did rally to his side. We talked to the other surviving relatives. There were sisters and a mother. Well, the mother had since passed, but they were on his side. They were not for him being executed.
Hmm.
So it was even a tighter case than a random murder in society or whatever. It was the example of how violence turns on the family. That's one of the first places where it, shows itself. And yet they were very supportive, even though he had committed this horrible act. I mean, I'm no let them loose kind of person. I worked with a lot of people on Missouri's death row who had committed some really heinous crimes, but it always seemed that they had some horrible experiences in their lives that brought them to that place. It just wasn't one solo act. It was a series of acts that brought them there, and then they wound up committing this horrendous act, which in most other people's eyes was horrible. And just this case, I remember Simmons and what happened there. And as a person, as a citizen, I was just, it sent chills up and down my spine.
Mm-hmm.
But when I look back with the cases that I worked on, I realized that something got that young man to wherever he was.
Brenda, thanks for the call.
And I,
you know, the governor of Kentucky did eventually commute the sentence of Kevin Stanford, whose case was the last juvenile death penalty case that the court heard before the case that's scheduled for tomorrow. And it's interesting. There's a lot of different ways one could read the commutation as a sign of, again, this evolving standard or of something very unique about what Kevin Stanford had become during his life in prison following the 1989 decision. And he'd become something of a rather unique and productive person. Again, gauging how these attitudes work and how these norms evolve and how they're expressed in terms of decisions both by juries but also by people in political office is a very important, obviously critical decision. And thinking broadly about the totality of these expressions of discomfort with the juvenile death penalty is very important to think about as we go into this case.
Jeffrey Fagan, thank you.
My pleasure.
Jeffrey Fagan, professor of law and public health at Columbia University's Law School. Joining us now is Dr. Jay Geed, Chief of Brain Imaging in the Child Psychiatry Branch at the National Institutes of Mental Health. We tracked him down at a conference in San Antonio, Texas, and it's good of you to step out for a moment to talk to us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Your research shows up in juvenile death penalty cases fairly frequently. Let's start by talking about what your work is. What are you mapping in juvenile brains?
What we're mapping is the trajectory of growth from childhood through adolescence and then into adulthood. And what has been most pertinent is that the part of the brain involved in controlling impulses and decision-making is very late to mature, probably on average around the age of 25.
And does that suggest that young people under the age of 25 are more impulsive and less able to control their actions?
Well, from the neuroimaging perspective, we can say with some certainty that the brain of a teen is different from the brain of a 25-year-old. And it's probably the case that teens as a group are more impulsive and weigh factors differently when making decisions than adults. But from the judicial perspective, I think that's where the science stops and the speculation starts.
In other words, no imaging could predict what one young person is going to do, and obviously the vast majority of people age 16 and 17 do not murder people.
Exactly. The biggest problem is going from group averages to individuals. It's statistically correct to say that men are taller than women. If you take 100 men randomly selected and 100 women randomly selected, almost every time the average of the men will be taller than the average of the women. But there are so many women taller than so many men, it'd be a lousy way to tell the sexes apart. And that's exactly what it's like for the brain imaging. On average, the teen brain patterns are quite different than the adult patterns, but there are many 16-year-olds who show excellent judgment, and there are many adults who will never develop good decision-making, no matter how old they get.
So there are limitations to the science at this point.
Yes, and most of the limitations, I think, stem from this depicting individual behavior from group averages.
So simply the fact that somebody is 16 years old at the time they committed this crime, obviously going to be much older by the time this case comes up for trial after all the appeals, but just because somebody was 16 years old, that's not an explanation as far as you're concerned?
Correct. Well, an issue that comes up a lot regarding this is that if we just use the brain images to assess brain maturation, the cutoff age would be closer to 25 years. And so many of the points made regarding that 16-year-old could also be applied to a 22-year-old. And so where we draw this line is somewhat arbitrary. But I should stress that I'm not saying that the neuroscience has no place in the courts, only that we need to make sure to identify what are the facts and what is speculation, and not to stretch the science too far to justify moral or political agendas.
Because, as you know, a lot of scientists are using research like yours in a brief that supports those who are opposing this use of the death penalty.
Exactly. And again, not to weigh in on one side or the other, but our fear is that this is a kind of a slippery slope if the science is overextended. And so what our efforts have been to try to make sure that we have clear identification of what are the facts about brain development and teen decision-making and what is the speculation. And what we fear and see happening is that that line gets blurred a lot in the courts and in the media.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Dr. Jay Geed of the National Institutes of Mental Health. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get some more callers up on the line. And this is Thomas, and Thomas is calling us from Keflavik in Iceland.
How you doing, sir?
Very well.
My question is to the doctor is that if a 16-year-old who has the cognitive processes of decision-making, even though that every 16-year-old is different when it comes to decision-making, right or wrong, what would be your stance in And if a 16-year-old who's healthy in the head department commits such a heinous crime that is even considered the death penalty, do you believe that the Supreme Court should pass a law that should not allow 16-year-olds to be executed, or should they be for it?
Yeah, I think that one of the difficulties is separating the science from the personal convictions. And from the science standpoint, in terms of what can we say from brain imaging or psychological studies about that individual 16-year-old, I think that it can inform the court and it can be part of the overall decision-making process. But in and of itself, I think that the science just isn't far enough along to be accurate enough to make these kind of life and death decisions.
You say it can inform the court. How?
I think that the fact that the teens may be more influenced by peer groups or by weighing different factors when making decisions could be one of many factors. And again, I hope this doesn't come out wrong, but the case law seems to be regarding mental retardation and whether people have the capacity to understand the situations and the punishments involved. And again, not saying that teens are in any way mentally retarded, but the idea of reduced capacity to make decisions and to understand consequences could conceivably be considered in the court systems. But I think that that is clearly in the realm of the judicial system and not in the realm of science.
Mm-hmm. Thomas, you calling from the airbase there at Keflavik?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Stick out me on.
Stay warm. doctor, in this kind of a case, I mean, you're talking about the application of, the statistical average of the brains of 16 and 17-year-olds. Would it be helpful in any way, is the imaging good enough that if someone is accused of a heinous crime who is that age, that a scan of that individual would be helpful?
Great question. And that's right, I think, at the cutting edge of the science now. And probably if you talk to 100 of us, you'd probably have 50 that say yes and 50 that say not yet. But my personal opinion is more in the not yet camp, that we're getting closer and closer to being able to understand individual brain function, decision-making, but that this is such a big step to actually be involved in life and death decisions that I think that the science needs to mature a bit more before used in this way.
Now, I suspect you're wrong only in the sense that you get 54, 50 against, and 50 who don't know.
I think that's more like it.
Jay Geed, thank you very much for being with us today. Appreciate you stepping out of that conference to join us.
Thank you very much.
Jay Geed is Chief of Brain Imaging in the Child Psychiatry Branch of the National Institutes of Mental Health, which is in Bethesda, Maryland. He joined us from a conference, as we mentioned, in San Antonio, Texas. When we come back from a short break, we'll look at how other industrialized nations deal with their violent juvenile criminals. And then we'll switch subjects to look at how police handle missing teenagers. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we'll finish up our discussion on the debate over juvenile offenders and the death penalty with a look at how other countries treat their violent young criminals. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255 or email totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Nick Balla, Professor of Family and Children's Law at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Nice of you to speak with us today.
Good afternoon.
Some brief history. First, when did Canada abolish the death penalty for juveniles, and was that a contentious issue at the time?
The last young person who was sentenced to death in Canada was in 1959. It was a case, and in fact, the young person then served a significant period of time and was released, and it's now coming to light that he was probably innocent as a result of a reinvestigation of that case. Death penalty was formally abolished in Canada in 1967 for both adults and juveniles.
And remind us, the death penalty is for juveniles, death penalty is all but extinct outside of the United States.
Well, it's not. It really has. The United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which every country save the United States in the world has signed on to, prohibits the use of the death penalty. There have been a few countries that have recently used the death penalty, Iran, for example, Congo, Pakistan. Those three countries have all renounced use of the death penalty for juvenile offenders. The United States is the only country in the world that continues to have a formal policy of death penalty for juvenile offenders.
How does Canada deal with young criminals who commit heinous crimes, aggravated murder?
Well, these are certainly cases that get a lot of attention and cause a lot of concern. In Canada, we have a provision that a young person who is charged with or found guilty of one of these offenses can be placed in an adult facility, can receive a life sentence. The way the process works, however, they will typically not be placed in an adult facility until reaching the age of 18, so they'll serve the first part of the sentence in a youth facility. And reflecting their limited moral development and accountability, they will have earlier parole eligibility than an adult offender.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, are Canadians following the debate that's going on in the United States over this?
Well, not so much over this specific issue, but there's certainly a lot of concern in Canada about how violent young offenders are treated. It's a controversial issue, but there is a pretty broad consensus that for the most serious offenses, there should be the possibility of life imprisonment, and sometimes young offenders, people who are under the age of 18 when they commit an offense, will serve their full life sentence. But most frequently, there's a recognition that there's greater potential for rehabilitation, and there should be lesser accountability reflecting their neurological development, their moral development. And in that sense, I think that there's probably a greater consensus than there is in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. Robert joins us from Sacramento, California.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
As you can see on the screen there, my family was impacted by violence by a juvenile offender who is now doing 15 to life at Folsom Prison. Just for your information, there are 900 lifers at Folsom. When the murder of my nephew first occurred, who himself was 16, happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, my brother initially, if he could have gotten his hands on the murderer, probably would have killed him himself. But over the years since the young man has been incarcerated, my brother has come full circle, as it were. As a family, we didn't believe in the death penalty. We're Roman Catholic. And the point I'm going to make here is that what we have observed in the young man, we went to his parole hearing 2 years ago, and he's eligible again in 2005. What we're looking for is acknowledgement of what he did, not the reason he did it, which, by the way, he said at his first parole hearing was he did it to impress his friends. Now, this is a 26, he's now 27, 28. He was 17 at the time. He did it to impress his friends and to show them that he had their backs, as it were. And, of course, the parole board asked him, well, what did you think murdering someone?
I'm sorry, Robert's phone has gone out on him. Just to wind that up, Nick Bala, there are a lot of people who argue that, in effect, somebody may have committed a heinous crime when they were 16 or 17 years old. 10 or 11 years later, they're different people.
I think that's right, and I think that caller was relating a very moving story about, you know, the experience of his own family, and understandably, victims' families have a range of views and have great difficulty ever getting over and never really will get over anything like this. But from a societal point of view, we have to recognize that someone who's 30 or 35 is a very different person. And even if someone is 18, they're physically fully formed, but their brain is still developing. There are people who are responsible for the death of others who we don't hold fully accountable. If someone is a drunk driver and runs somebody over, we put the drunk driver in jail, but we don't say you didn't have the necessary mental element to be held fully accountable, even though you caused someone's death.
Mm.
We take account of the context, the intent, the state of moral development. And with young people, they're simply not adults, and it's appropriate to treat them in a different way. Every country but the United States recognizes that.
There are differing opinions. Of course, the Supreme Court will be hearing some of those tomorrow as well. Professor Nick Bala, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Professor Bala teaches family and children's law at Canada's Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario.